a few more random questions. Okay, so this is not a question, this is just a comment. I mentioned yesterday or a couple of days ago the idea of they call spiritual bypassing. And apparently there's a book of that name, so if anybody's interested in learning more about it, check it out. Right. Is it necessary to experience samadhi before doing metta meditation? No, it's the other way around. The purpose of doing metta meditation is in order to gain samadhi. I'm not quite sure where that. Sometimes it's difficult to understand where a question's coming from when you only get a little phrase like that. So I just sometimes have to guess. We'll try to guess what the problem is, but what I've noted a lot of the time there seems to be a misunderstanding. People don't with what meditation, the relationship between meditation methods and the states of meditation. People, for example, a lot of people think that samadhi has something intrinsically to do with breath meditation. This is not the case. It's got nothing to do with it as such. Samadhi, what we call samadhi, the Pali word or Sanskrit word, means a state of coalescence of the mind. It's a state of consciousness where all the different parts of the mind come together and there's a balance and a harmony in the mind. I'm going to talk more about this later on during the retreat. But the basic point here is that state of mind or state of consciousness has got nothing to do with any particular meditation method like breath meditation or metta meditation or whatever. The methods are simply the path to reach that state of samadhi. But the state itself is just a state of consciousness. It's not a meditation method. Is that difference clear? I mean, it seems clear to me, but I just, it's just a question which comes up many times, and so I'm just wondering whether there's some misunderstanding or confusion that I don't understand. But anyway, okay. So the next question: when our family members have hurt us for our whole lives, how do we overcome thoughts and feelings of hate? So that's a very touching, a very difficult question. It's not easy, and I have to admit, from my point of view, I can only imagine. I come from a very loving family, and my family members have never hurt me, so I can't imagine what that would feel like for myself. And this is something which has been brought up before, that when we talk about, I say before, I mean on previous retreats, when we talk about, I did a metta retreat for a bunch of psychologists in Sydney last year. So if you try to teach metta to psychologists, they immediately make a lot of things very complicated. You know, like you say, oh, it's like the love of a mother for a child, and they say, but some mothers just can't love their children. Yeah, well, I know sometimes, but most of the time. And so things always get much more complicated, which is fair enough. I mean, that's just bringing the real world into it. Yeah? These things are not that simple. And when we use these things, like the mother's love and so on, as a metaphor, an example of great love that can happen, I mean, for some people that's not their experience, that's not their reality. They haven't experienced the love of a mother. And sometimes their relationship with a mother can be very traumatic, or with other family members. And this is not at all uncommon. This is not an issue that I can sort of discuss in too much detail, and it is something that I think needs more careful and more personal attention than I can give in just answering the question, or that I can give in a retreat. And you know, if somebody feels that they need that, then I would urge them to seek it out and try to find that kind of personal and detailed consideration through therapy or through whatever means is available. But I'll just share with you one experience that was told to me in my last retreat I taught, and which I found very moving. There was one lady doing the retreat who, it was her first meditation retreat. And it was quite a fascinating thing, because it was only a four-day retreat, and I did a number of interviews with her over the time. But when I first met her in the first retreat, she seemed, you know, quite a kind of bubbly, quite happy kind of person, extroverted and so on. And then gradually she started telling me about her life, and you know that one reason which she came to the retreat was because she'd recently had a divorce from a man she'd been married to like 15 years or something like that, and she had two young children she was looking after. And she said she wanted to be able to be a better mother for the children. And as the retreat went on, and they had some more interviews, and gradually it sort of came out that actually it had been quite a psychologically abusive relationship, and she'd suffered a lot of trauma through that. But also what also then came out was that she'd suffered terrible physical abuse as a young child from her father, and had dreadful emotional scarring because of that, but also had a lot of hatred for her mother, because her mother basically enabled it and let the father get away with everything. Then it turned out, of course, that was the reason why she'd stayed in this abusive marriage for so long, because her mother had kept on telling her, you've got to stay with him, you can't leave him. And it wasn't until she was able to sort of break away from that she was able to leave, and she was obviously much better off for it. But what was interesting through all this, and she was just kind of telling me these things as it came out in the interviews, and what was really interesting was that after about 3 days during the retreat, she was sitting in meditation, and as she was sitting in meditation, suddenly she had this image came into her mind. She was an artist, so she had a very visual kind of imagination, and this image came into her mind. Very vivid image of a child's bedroom, and through the window was coming a very soft golden sunlight. And then she saw that on the bed was sitting this young girl. And she went towards this young girl, and as she came closer to her, she realized, of course, that the young girl was her before any of this had happened. And she went up and she just gave her just the biggest hug. And after that, things were so much better. And she said to me that there was a time when she realized that all this time she'd been looking for love from everybody else around her and blaming them because they weren't able to give her what she needed. And she realized that if she was actually able to love herself and able to fully accept herself, then that was what would let her be able to let go of all that anger and resentment she had towards all those others in her life as well. So that was like a very, very major shift for her. And to me, that it really showed me something very powerful, even though I'd been practicing and teaching this method for so many years, but still somehow it keeps on uncovering new things, keeps on delving into places that I didn't know, And in that realization, that very, very simple realization, I think is, to me, is one of the keys of why it's so important to be able to do the metta and to love oneself. And if we can't love ourselves, then whenever we get into a relationship with anybody else, no matter what we think of it, no matter what terms we try to paint it in, actually what we're doing is we're getting into that relationship because we want them to make us happy, because they can make us feel loved. And as soon as we do that, and there's a sense in which that demeans everything, doesn't it? Because actually you're not loving them because of who they are. You're not loving them because of what makes them happy. You're loving them because of what they can do for you. They become just an instrument to satisfy your happiness. And that's why we do it. And I think if we're going to be honest with ourselves, we have to admit that that's part of normal, everyday human relationships. It's not the whole thing. I'm not being cynical here. I'm not being reductive. I'm not saying that's all there is to it. I'm saying that's part of it. And so when we're able to really love and accept ourselves, then that kind of grasping and clinging side to things is just not there anymore. So I'm not sure if that's going to be of any use, but that's just a few thoughts on that from one example that I've seen. Okay. Here's another one. Can I give some words of encouragement for people who've recently stopped a drug and alcohol addiction? Oh, words of encouragement. Yippee. Congratulations. Sadhu. I think it kind of, to me, relates to what I was just saying just now, that in a sense addiction is also comes from that same kind of place, doesn't it? Yeah, that you don't have that acceptance of yourself. A lot of the time when people drink and take drugs, it's because you want to block everything out, because you can't stand to be with yourself. Yeah? And so it has that, there's that very kind of destructive side to it. And so I think, again, that idea of accepting yourself. And I think the fact if somebody has stopped that addiction, has come off the drugs or the alcohol, then that's a sign that they're moving towards that acceptance. They're moving towards acceptance of responsibility for their actions, and hopefully moving towards an understanding of themselves. One thing I think which is... There is. I mean, it's interesting if you look historically. There's actually a close relationship between drug use and meditation. And in the West, the meditation sort of was an outgrowth of the hippie generation, wasn't it? Yeah. So in the 60s, everyone went out and smoked dope and took acid and so on. And I was like, wow, man, that's. That's so amazing. But then after a while, you know, you can't do it anymore, so you have to, meditation, you can sort of do it without all the harmful side effects. But, and it's interesting to me, it's very interesting as a historian, that exactly the same thing seems to have happened when meditation was developed in ancient India. The oldest Indian scriptures we have, the Rig Veda, talk a lot about this god called Soma. And no one knows quite who this god Soma was. Some people think he was magic mushrooms. Some people think he was marijuana. Some people think he was something like a kind of speed or something like that, a phedra. But certainly it was some kind of mind-altering substance. And when the Aryan people came to India, they no longer had access to Soma. So there's all these hymns lamenting about the death of Soma. And it seems that that was one of the spurs to the development of meditation, and people had, through use of drugs, had access to some altered states of consciousness. And then that gradually came to be replaced by maybe using more kind of rituals or incantations, chanting, and various kinds of things, and gradually evolved into meditation. So that's maybe also something to reflect on for one's own personal use and one's own personal life. Actually, one of the reasons that we take drugs and so on, because we want to, we're changing the world by changing our minds. And drugs and alcohol change your mind, and they change the way that you see the world. But of course they do that in very chaotic and quite damaging ways. But what they do reveal is how subjective things are, how much that world out there is not given, it's not just present, but it's a world which we actually create and we're actually part of. So we're keeping that kind of insight, but then applying it with more wisdom and more responsibility, then through meditation we learn at a much deeper level that same truth, that actually the world is something that we're creating moment by moment. And also through meditation, and we learn to accept ourselves, we learn to be content, to be happy inside ourselves, and so we're not looking for those external sources. We don't need them. The source of the problem has been removed. I don't want to go too long on this topic for now, but I just make a more general remark here. Is there's been I believe that in our current society, our efforts to stamp out, to combat drug use are entirely misguided, and it's all this kind of macho rhetoric about the war on drugs and spending billions and billions of dollars making criminals out of people who smoke a joint or something like that. And I think it's a complete waste of time. What really needs to be done is to look, well, what are the causes? What are people? Why do people feel the need to change their minds? What's missing in their lives? What is there that's so lost? And to try to supply that need or that sense of meaning which is driving people towards these substances. I think this is much more useful. Okay. Okay, so the question here is, when we're meditating, how should we try to penetrate the insight into impermanent suffering and not self? So this is referring to the development of vipassana in our meditation. Now, I mentioned a little bit earlier that I think the idea of samadhi sometimes is misunderstood, that there's this kind of, people think that samadhi means breath meditation or something like that. I think the same thing is also a problem in insight or vipassana. And what's happened these days is that various kinds of meditation techniques are called vipassana, and we become so used to this that it's hard to get your head around. But in when the Buddha used the word vipassana, he never used the word vipassana to refer to a meditation technique. Okay, so this idea today that you can go and do a 10-day vipassana retreat, that's not how the Buddha used the word vipassana at all. What the Buddha meant by the word vipassana was literally insight, or perhaps even better, maybe discernment is a better understanding of the word vipassana. That is, it's that realization which is the vipassana. It's the actual moment of insight. It's not the method that you've used to get there that is called vipassana, okay? So just like with samatha meditation, we can do many, many different kinds of meditation. We can do breath meditation, we can do metta, we can do kasina meditation on a colour or something, we can focus on a light, we can meditate on the different parts of the body. So many things we can do to meditate, all of which will lead to unification of mind, which is what we call samadhi. The same thing with vipassana, that there's no single method that is vipassana, but actually that there are many, many ways that we could use to investigate, to reflect, to inquire. And all of those ways will lead to deepening our wisdom and lead to the emergence of this thing called insight. So it's important not to confuse the method. What we call vipassana meditation is not actually vipassana. What it is it's a set of techniques or guidelines which experience has shown to be conducive and helpful for the arising of vipassana. Okay, that's all. It's not the vipassana itself. All right. So I hope that distinction is clear. So then to come back to the question, what can we do in meditation to give rise to these things? Actually, there's no single answer to that. The Buddha taught vipassana in so many different ways, and there's so many different methods that we can use. And people today are used to the kind of the methods of, you Mahasi technique, you watch the, use the feeling of the rising and falling of the abdomen as your main object of meditation, and then you note miscellaneous phenomena as they occur. Or if you practice Goenka technique, you sort of scan through the body and note the sensations in the body and so on. And so these are techniques which people have developed as ways to help facilitate the arising of vipassana. If we look in the Buddhist suttas, we see lots of other ways that vipassana has arisen. Some of them quite extraordinary. For example, there's the story of the the monk or the nun will they say that they go into their kuti and they turned out the lamp in their hut, and then bingo, their mind's freed. I don't know if they said bingo, but anyway. Yeah, or another one, Bhadda Kundala Kesa, one of my favourite nuns from the early times, and she became enlightened when she washed her feet and watched the foot washing water disappear into the ground. And then how she gained insight into impermanence. Yeah. And or the other one, the nun who wandered for 20 years. She said she wandered for 20 years and didn't find peace of mind even for as long as the snap of the fingers. Yeah. That's pretty bad, isn't it? Yeah. You've been here for 4 days on retreat and you think... Already thinking it's getting a bit desperate. Imagine that, 20 years, nothing. Just distress. So she gave up, got a rope, tied it round the limb of a tree as she was going to kill herself. Put the rope around her neck. And just then, her mind was freed. Yeah? Just then. So that's another technique you can try if you like. And we can, I don't know, we can maybe put some hooks on the ceiling or something. But these things I think are very, very important, because the way these come back to the point I was making in the talk last night, that insight, the real insight, is not something that comes from a method. It's not something that's predetermined. Yeah? It just happens. So what we do when we're practicing insight is we cultivate, we develop our mind in a way which is conducive to the arising of insight. And there are many different ways we can do that. In the context of metta meditation, I'm going to talk more about this later on in the retreat, but in the context of metta meditation, one thing you do is just at the end of the metta, when you let the feeling of metta go, and you just watch that end. Just watch the feeling of metta end. You step back from it and just watch it. Fades away. So in that moment, we're contemplating impermanence, we're seeing the ending of things. So this is how we are, by practicing in that way, we're like programming our mind little bit by little bit. Even that, just that one little bit, we're still programming our mind to see the impermanence of things. Inclining the mind to see that things in that way. if you want to do more structured or more extensive practice of vipassana, probably the most easily accessible way of doing that is through contemplating the six senses. And again, I'll talk more about this later on, but just as a simple vipassana exercise, you just go through each of the six senses and contemplate the eye. Yeah. This is you're meditating, you realize this is my eye in here, and out there is the sights, the things that I see. You realize that there's these two different things, and separate and so and dependent on these things, this eye consciousness, visual consciousness arises. And you just pay attention to those three things. Keep on focusing, keep on watching them until you get a reasonably clear idea of what those three things are like. And then you do the same for the ear and sounds, nose and smells, tongue and tastes, the body and touches. If you want to, you can also contemplate the mind in the same way, or if you like, at the beginning of the developing vipassana, you can leave the mind to one side because the mind is much more subtle, much more refined object of contemplation. And so once, if you contemplate in that way, contemplate each of the senses, get a clear idea, clearly discern what each of those senses is like. And then you just start to play with it. For example, you compare what each of those is like compared to each other. What's sight like compared to sound? And just pay attention, comparing one to the other. And as you do that, more and more you do that, you realize that each of the senses has its completely different flavor. Yeah? And look at the interactions between those things. Yeah? So for example, like when you're sitting in meditation, maybe you hear a sound, and then you immediately say, oh, that's a bird, that's a rooster crowing. Yeah? And then maybe there's an image comes into your mind of this rooster. But then you realize that these are all completely different things. Yeah, sound is one thing, the idea of it is another, the picture of it is another. Yeah, and the more and more you do that, the more and more you realize that this world that we live in is something that we're constantly creating inside our mind. We realize that we don't actually see people, for example. You just see light. Light is all that we see. We don't see people. When you're talking to somebody, you don't hear words, you only hear sounds. The words are something that's put together in your mind. And so by practicing, by analysing, breaking down experience into these separate parts and then gradually building them up, then we're starting to get an awareness of the conditionality of things. We're starting to get an awareness of the impermanence of these things, because we realise that the notion we take to be a person actually is a sight, and that sight is not always there. It's there for a while and then it stops. Or it's a sound that's there for a while and then it stops. And it's the idea of permanence that was something that we build up in our minds. So that's just some simple instructions for vipassana meditation. So you can play around with that. And I'll talk more about it later on in the retreat. Okay, so here's a request. I'll pass this one on to Bianca. Can we please have the heater off for the 8 a.m. sit? It gets too warm and causes sloth and torpor. Thank you. Anyway, I'm sure everybody in the room likes things at a slightly different temperature. That's a simple fact of human physiology, isn't it? Yeah? Some people are hot, some people are cold. So we can't expect it to be perfect for everyone. Anyway. Okay. As this is a metta retreat, can we go around radiating metta and smiling at each other? Or do we have to be serious and looking down? There will still be silence but smiles all around. Oh, give me a break. if you want to go around smiling at everyone else, go on, please. I remember one time, it can be a great thing to do. One time I caught a bus when I was in Sydney, and I caught a bus to one of the suburbs, and this guy got on the bus, and he was like very, very funny. He was obviously a bit mad, but but mad in a good way. And as soon as he got on, he just said, he said to everyone, the women are all beautiful and the men are all handsome, and just sat down on his seat. Everyone's like, what's going on? And he just kept on getting up and saying these kinds of things. He said, I just want everybody to know that the driver of this bus is a true professional and you're in the best of hands. So please, everyone, just relax and enjoy the trip. It's going to be great. Yeah, so by the end of the trip, everyone was so happy. It was the best bus trip I'd had for ages. Yeah. It was really good. So, okay, so here's someone saying that they couldn't sustain the feeling of metta in the second stage for a loved person. It got flat after a while. What should to do? So if feeling goes flat, then you can come back to do metta for yourself and see how that goes. If that's not working, then maybe just stop for a while, have a break, and come back to it. Or if you still feel like you have a lot of energy and you want to keep on meditating, then maybe that's time to think about some of those tricks and ideas that I mentioned the other night about trying to play around with it to give rise to the feeling. Of course, it's quite natural that the feeling of metta will fluctuate, especially when we're starting. And that's why we're meditating. So we want to learn to make it more steady. So it will go up and down. If it just goes down a bit and stays down for a while, we just keep on practicing, don't need to do anything. But then if it keeps on staying down, it's not coming back, then we have to think about trying to do something maybe to try to spark the feeling off or get it going again. The actual specific quality that does that, again, this is something I'll talk more about later, but the specific quality is the quality we call rapture or bhiti. And rapture is a sense of uplift, which gives an excitement and an interest in the meditation. So it's that quality of rapture, which that's really the thing which sparks off that feeling of metta, which stops it from getting flat. Okay. Okay, so Bibhante, your flexibility in answering questions from the floor is very appreciated. However, he also spoke about the usefulness of boundaries and structures in providing safety and security. I'm wondering about keeping Q&A in written form to provide boundary and structure so that we can end on time. Well, fair enough. I mean, just to say for everyone that I didn't realise that there was a time. Anyway, I should probably read the schedule. But if you are getting tired in the evening and you want to go and have a rest, then please do so. The other advantage is when we put pen to paper, we can think through what we have to say, which can encourage mindfulness, I think. And then says, well, maybe we should do it with Ajahn Brahm style, having a show of hands. I don't know. I quite like having a few, some questions from the floor, because I think that lets people respond to what's actually happened in the Dhamma talk. Yeah, so I personally quite like that. But I will promise to try to keep an eye on the time. Is there a time that we're supposed to be finishing? No, there's no finish time. All right, but if you do feel like ending, then don't feel it's not rude or anything to leave during the Q&A or whatever. You're not required to stay. Oh, here's another question just a note about the oral questions. If I could rephrase or paraphrase the questions before answering, because sometimes people. It's hard to hear what the original question was, so that's a good point. I'll remember to do that. Okay. So here's another interesting question. If feelings are in the body, can meditation alone purify the body? Or do we include body work like yoga as well to unlock the trapped metta? That's an interesting question. I think the answer is probably it depends. I think that if you look in Theravadan countries and the way that meditation is practiced and so on, that there's usually not much emphasis on the kind of the physical exercise and so on, which you often find in Western spirituality. But also, having lived in Thailand and lived in the forest tradition and so on, you see, well, there's probably a reason for that, is that people are actually much more culturally, much more at home in their bodies. And they don't seem to be so kind of alienated and cut off from it. I mentioned the other day, you know, say in Thailand, people always growing up sitting on the floor. They tend to be much more flexible and kind of loose in their bodies and more not so uptight and not so trapped. And I think that when, you know, in the recent decades, and we've seen as the spiritual movements have grown in the West, there's a strong emphasis on yoga and Tai Chi and these various forms of physical kind of spiritual physical exercises. And I think there's actually a good reason for that, and I think that that's almost like an unconscious acknowledgement from Western people that we have dislocated ourselves from our body, that we have become separated from it, and that we do tend to lock up a lot of tensions and so on inside of our body. So I think perhaps that's to some degree a cultural thing, and perhaps also, I'm sure, also a personal thing. For some people, I know that doing yoga and so on is very useful. Whether it's necessary or not, I'm not so sure, but I certainly think it's helpful. And I'd always encourage somebody to do some yoga or Tai Chi or whatever to help support their meditation practice. Okay, so that's all the questions for this morning. So questions have gone on a little bit longer this morning than previous mornings, so not sure if we've got really time to do a proper guided meditation. So at the risk of risk of annoying someone, but I might ask before we finish, is there any questions? Anyone has any other questions? And then we might just go over to the ordinary meditation. Dania. Right, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, so what Dani is referring to is a particular... I should repeat the question, as I said I would. So Dani is asking about the particular teaching framework called the gradual training, which is found very often in the suttas. And in the gradual training, it doesn't actually mention any specific meditation method, but the course of training and practice leads up to abandoning the hindrances and developing the four jhanas. So then the question is this the kind of the essential thing, the important thing is abandoning hindrances and developing jhanas? And I would say yes. What the gradual training is a very kind of general outline. Gradual training is simply a more detailed explanation of the threefold training, sila, samadhi, panya, yeah? Ethics, concentration and wisdom. So that's kind of explained in more detail, particularly in a monastic context. and it's called the gradual training. And in the gradual training, it doesn't mention any particular meditation method. It just says, you know, once you've practiced with getting your sila together and you've listened, understood the Dhamma, gained faith, got your sila together, practiced with mindfulness, practiced with sense restraint, contentment and all of the other things, and then you go and sit down and the word it uses is establish mindfulness. Parimukhang satim upatthapetva. And then it talks about abandoning the five hindrances. So what I think is that the meditation object is, whatever the meditation method we're using, really is just implied and slipped in there under the title of establishing mindfulness. And that's really what's implying the doing the meditation. And so any of the meditation subjects can be done in that context. And in fact, if you look at the variations in the way that teaching is taught in different places in the suttas, you'll find that in some places different meditations are mentioned at that point. So the point here is that there's no requirement that you can fulfill that training and fulfill the development of the Noble Eightfold Path through the use of any of the particular meditation objects. The reason why there seems to be a bit of ambiguity around this topic is because in the suttas it doesn't tend to make that point so explicitly. In the suttas it tends to, in certain places, teach the meditation methods, and in other places it teaches the sort of the general teachings on the path, and it doesn't necessarily make explicit the relationship between those two things. Probably does in a few places, but typically it doesn't so much. So that was really left up to the later developments in the Abhidhamma and the commentaries, which makes those connections explicit. Okay, any other questions? Okay, so I'll go off and get ready for the interviews. And for everyone, please, happy meditating. And I hope you all survive another day.